This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Politicians often like to bring up the U.S.'s, quote, dependency on foreign oil as a popular talking point. Well, that phrase originated in the 1970s when the Arab oil-producing countries launched an embargo on the United States and provoked an energy crisis. Americans who remember that time period recall long lines of cars waiting to get gas and gas stations simply running out of gas. It was a moment of national vulnerability for a country that was intent on building up its global dominance. Writing about that chapter of U.S. history in a new book is Meg Jacobs. She teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. Her earlier book was called Pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in 20th Century America. And she's just written the book Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Welcome to the show, Meg.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's begin with how the whole crisis began, because I think we forget the reason why this embargo was launched in the first place. Just starting internationally, there was a serious international crisis, a war at the heart of this. And that translated into the energy crisis here in the U.S. that consumed us. But how did it all begin?
That's a good question. And certainly it was an international crisis. It was precipitated by the Yom Kippur War, which started when Egypt and Syria invaded Israel, and the United States came to the defense of Israel. And in retaliation, the Arab members of OPEC instituted embargo on exporting oil to the United States. But the real crisis in some ways started even earlier. We could say that it started with our massive dependence and reliance on oil as a major fuel source for our economy. And it was that dependence, that growing dependence and our increasing reliance on exports that made us vulnerable to what the Arab members of OPEC called the oil weapon.
So the Arab members of OPEC, Saudi Arabia, and these various oil producing countries were able to, in sort of one fell swoop on paper, attack the United States without lifting a single weapon, right?
Yes, and indeed it was shocking. It was shocking. So some called it an energy Pearl Harbor. Although, as you say quite correctly, this was an economic attack without lifting, without any weapons, use of weapons, just through the blockading of shipment of oil, policed by the large major oil companies who felt that they had to go along. Even if it was through economic rather than military means, it came as a dramatic shock to the American public, and many feared that this was the end of the world as they had known it, the end of their reliance on oil to heat their homes and fuel their industry, and above all else, motor their cars.
And it should be noted that the idea of an embargo is one that the United States itself has used many times around the world as a weapon, if you will, against states like Cuba, Iraq, Iran. The U.S. has supported sanctions and embargoes that have really impacted the lives of other countries. But given the U.S.'s position in the international stage, I suppose Americans didn't expect that they would ever be subject to it. How did Americans respond? How did this embargo translate on the streets of American cities for those of us who weren't around at the time?
Yes. Well, given that this happened in the fall of 1973, just at the conclusion of the Vietnam War, there was no military response. And so what that meant was, by and large, the United States was going to have to deal with the shortages, which Richard Nixon, who was president at the time, said would be anywhere from roughly 10 to 17%. This put Americans into a panic, quite literally, generating long lines, mile-long lines, hours upon hours of waiting on these lines, people running out of fuel as they waited on these lines, a real panic, a real sense that the only solution was to do the irrational act of constantly filling up your tank, thereby exacerbating the problem.
And in fact, it got so bad that people started stealing gas right out of other folks' cars. You know, did it translate into violence in the streets?
It did translate into violence. As you say, people started to put locks on their tanks for fear that their gas would be stolen. Fist fights at gasoline lines, even unfortunately, shootings and stabbings. And there was a true moment. I would say that the peak of the crisis of this panic at the pump came 4 months into the embargo, when the nation's truckers, who of course drove for a living, staged an 11-day shutdown, and all commerce came to a stop. And the trucker strike was incredibly violent. So those truckers who were on strike wanted to make sure that those who kept driving their trucks stayed off the road. So there were snipers on the side of the road. People striking truckers dropped bricks from overpasses, and there were deaths that resulted from this violence as well.
So how did this crisis and what it ended up translating into on the streets point to the weakness of the U.S. government? How did Americans view the role of government? Because, of course, if an outside set of countries is imposing this embargo, you know, one could argue it wasn't really the government's fault. What could they do?
Well, this was an era in which Americans really still expected the government to do something. And part of the reason that there was so much pandemonium at the pumps is because of the perception that government was doing nothing. One of the popular suggestions, which again is impossible for us to believe today, it just seems so far-fetched, was that that government should put into place a rationing program, complete with ration booklets and ration coupons, so that this way the idea was is that everyone could get their fair share. And this came within 8 votes of passing in the Senate, which is quite remarkable. When it failed to pass, this is when states adopted their own odd-even rationing as a sort of stopgap measure. The thing that Americans were equally as upset about, in addition to sort of worrying about the loss of supply, was the rising prices. This is the first time that gasoline cost more than $1 a gallon. And, you know, this is an era we can get a sense of how new this was. At the time, pumps in the country only had room for 2 digits, so they could not even accommodate gasoline prices above $1 a gallon. And the number one demand of the striking truckers and of consumers and drivers across the country was that Congress actually roll back the prices at the pump. There was this perception at the time, even if this started because of an international crisis, that the large American oil companies, known simply as Big Oil, that they were somehow fomenting or at least exacerbating or taking advantage of the crisis in order to raise prices. So there were rumors circulating, and you know, we're not just talking about a fringe element. 3/4 of the public believed that this was an artificial conspiracy launched against the public by Big Oil. And there was this idea that tankers waited offshore filled with oil that would come and deliver the fuel once prices reached a certain height.
And how much of that thread continues today, those ideas that began, that kind of were birthed in the energy crisis of the 1970s, rear their head every time gas prices go up, even today. And every time we, you know, have politicians talking about the U.S.'s dependency on oil, it seems as though the reaction from the public and the reaction from politicians have these echoes of the 1970s.
In some senses, but in some ways they're sort of more ceremonial, in the sense that no one truly believes that Washington's going to intervene to set the prices at the pump. And in fact, that is what they do in response to public demands. The government actually institutes price controls. It institutes allocation measures, so it says how much each part of the country should get, which is an unbelievable intervention that is inconceivable today. Today, if prices rise, we talk about these sort of global market conditions like rising demand from China or India, or recently the sort of collapse of OPEC power to stabilize markets, or the, you know, or the increase in production from fracking that has also led to declining prices. We talk about these as market phenomenon, and we don't have sort of expectations that government's going to sort of intervene in any way.
How did the energy crisis impact Nixon's presidency? Obviously, Nixon is known for the Watergate scandal.
Right. Right.
How did the energy crisis overlap with this?
It overlapped perfectly in time. That is, the Saturday Night Massacre, which is really the moment that's seen to sort of escalate the Watergate scandal and sort of the White House involvement in a cover-up, occurred just at the moment when OPEC was announcing the embargo, and they sort of mapped perfectly together. What's interesting is that this is... my book is the first look at the energy crisis because so much of our attention gets focused on Watergate, which is not to say it was insignificant, Watergate, and did ultimately lead to the president resigning. But at the time, both the president and pollsters and average Americans thought that the energy crisis was in some ways a bigger problem. Public opinion polls showed that this seemed to be a more pressing concern, the sort of lack of fuel at affordable prices concerned Americans because it impacted them on a daily basis. They could see the long lines, they could see the fistfights, they could see the rising prices, and they felt the pinch in their pocketbooks.
And then, of course, how did future presidents Ford and Carter react? And I'm wondering also if you can answer how the energy crisis ended up transforming the U.S. political landscape and pushing it in the direction of conservatism.
Yeah, so, you know, the lesson from Vietnam and then Watergate was that Americans couldn't trust their presidents, their elected officials. The lesson of the energy crisis was that Washington didn't work. And that became really paramount and clear when we had the second oil shock in 1979 under Jimmy Carter. So the gas lines return in 1979, again triggered by a foreign situation with the Iranian Revolution. But really, it was Jimmy Carter's fault. That's how the American public perceived it, because Jimmy Carter came into office promising really to solve the energy crisis. His big solution was that Americans should cut back, and this is his famous cardigan sweater speech that he gives from the White House library, where he asks everyone to conserve energy. This is not what Americans wanted to hear. They wanted to hear that he would prevent the gas lines, that he would ensure supply, that he would guarantee prices didn't go up. And when they did, everyone was certain he was to blame. So Carter Kiss My Gas became a popular bumper sticker, and as you suggest, played into the hands of the conservatives. And when Ronald Reagan runs in 1980, he can point to the energy crisis as exhibit A as to why government fails.
So meanwhile, what is happening on the international scene? We started out talking about the spark that led to this energy crisis, the Yom Kippur War. What is happening on the foreign policy scene? Of course, the United States, you know, doesn't sit back and simply work on how to reduce dependence domestically. There was much going on internationally at that time as well.
Right. So at the same time, you have a growing reliance on markets and a scaling back of government involvement in the domestic energy industry from Reagan on, you have an increasing shifting of priorities to military priorities, to guaranteeing supply from abroad. So originally, when the Arab embargo happens and we're importing about a third of our oil, Richard Nixon says, he declares project independence, that's the goal of American energy policy, to become self-sufficient. It's sort of an early version of drill, baby, drill. But eventually that policy falls by the wayside and instead becomes replaced with a growing militarization of the Persian Gulf as a way to sort of stabilize and secure the free flow of oil from that region, a policy that reaches culmination with the Gulf War in 1991.
Hmm. And then here, meanwhile, domestically, what's really interesting in looking at your book is that one of the ways in which government tried to deal with the energy crisis was to encourage Americans to conserve, drive at lower speeds, and Americans didn't like that. But here we are today in 2016 with a climate change crisis, right. And you know, we're still not really there or talking about conservation. You know, we have hybrid cars, et cetera, but it seems as though there was a moment when we could have used the energy crisis to actually think about real conservation in this country, and instead the American national and international dominance and our sort of position on the world stage went hand in hand with this refusal to conserve and American hubris. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I mean, I think you stated it well. So that Jimmy Carter tried, he was the president of all the ones that you've mentioned who really put conservation at the fore, and it just wasn't something that Americans wanted to hear. So his famous Malay speech in the summer of 1979, where he tells Americans, you know, our problem is over indulgence and using too much energy, and this has made us morally weak as well as sort of politically and economically and internationally weak. We need to cut back. And this is not what Americans who are waiting on lines wanted to hear. And when Ronald Reagan comes in, he says, you know, he's committed, it's in the Republican plank, that he will eliminate the mandatory 55 mile per hour speed limit that Richard Nixon put into place. And our increasing reliance on oil to fuel transportation remains today. So even as cars become much more efficient, a sort of result of public policies that began in the 1970s, Americans drive three times as far as they did at the time of the Arab embargo. And so you're quite right that today the conversation of an energy crisis is linked to climate change in a way that did not exist in the 1970s when the concern was over supply. But even as we see progress like the Paris Treaty and efforts by Obama to cut back emissions, we still use an ever-growing amount of oil in this country.
Right. Well, Meg, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for having this conversation with us. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Meg Jacobs teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. Her earlier book was called Pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in 20th Century America. We've just been discussing her latest book, Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find our interviews on iTunes and Vimeo.